John Allen presents the Creepy Crawl Podcast. Oh my creepy creeps, welcome home to your cozy, comfortable, loving confines here at the Creepy Crawl Podcast. My name, John Allen. Your name's probably something awesome, because if you're here, it's only logical that you're awesome. Before I get into the imaginary fake intro music for today, I want to say something about the music you just heard. You're probably thinking, wow, this is a case about Emmett Till, very brutal, dark case. Why are you playing a 60s banger? That was a party song. And you would be half correct. But Dancing in the Streets also became, later on, one of the civil rights anthems. So I think it makes sense. Since today is all about Emmett Till and the atrocities that followed that case, that music you don't hear, but we're going to pretend you do, is the song Mississippi Goddamn by Nina Simone. And after the travesty that this episode covers, you'll be saying Mississippi Goddamn from the top of your lungs. Speaking of the top of lungs, I'm shouting from the top of mine. I'm shouting thank you for everyone, the lifeblood, the lifeline, the heart, the engine of the show, and that is you who helps keep me going. That is my Patreons, that is my Venmo crew, it's all of you. If you'd like to join these sexy beasts, please do so. I could use some microphones, I could use the help. Times are tough. You can do so by going to patreon.com/creepycrawl. You can also go to Venmo at Jonathan-Allen-154. If you can't, I get it. These are tough financial times for all of us. However, do follow me on Twitter. That handle is at WriterJohnAllen, no H. I like to post photos and things that tie the story together. Also, I have a new Facebook group. It is growing. Please go to facebook.com/groups/ The Creepy Crawl Podcast. Now, research for today's episode occurred on April 27th. And coincidentally, on this day in history in 1927, Coretta Scott King was born. Coretta Scott King is the civil rights activist and wife of Martin Luther King Jr. I'm telling you, creeps, I did not plan it this way. It's kind of a civil rightsy sort of case, and then boom, I do the research, and who was born on this day? Coretta Scott King. It's sort of eerie. You're probably sick of me saying, oh, synchronicity, synchronicity, but I'm telling you, it gets eerie sometimes, in a good way. Well, today's going to be a tough one, so be forewarned if you are sensitive to atrocities like what you're about to hear. I will say, though, it's definitely important that you do hear it. The case of Emmett Till is brutal, it's shameful, it's disgusting, and it's also one of the most important catalysts to the civil rights movement. It is history, it is our history, for better or for worse. We must own it, we must understand it, and we must grow from it. So, with that, pop a Xanax for the anger you're about to feel. Tighten your stomachs for the gross events you're about to hear about. And, as we do, creepy crawl with me. So I think it's important to get beyond the actual terrible photo of Emmett Till in death and get to know who he was as a person. He was basically a child. He just out of puberty when he died. Emmett Till was born in 1941 in Chicago. Emmett's mother, Mamie, she herself was born in the small Delta town of Webb, Mississippi. The Delta region encompasses the large multi-county area of northwestern Mississippi in the watershed of the Yahoo and Mississippi rivers. When Mamie was 2 years old, her family wisely moved to Argo, Illinois, and that was part of this thing called the Great Migration. This is when rural black families from the South sort of moved to the North to escape the violence and lack of opportunity and unequal treatment under the law. Not to say that the North was some utopia or some type of safe haven. It certainly had its share of racism. It certainly had its share of prejudice, inequality, and so forth. But when you try to scale that with the Jim Crow Deep South, it's no fucking contest. The Jim Crow Deep South of this era was ridiculous. Literally, you could lynch black people in the streets with the assistance of a police officer. It was, if you were of certain skin color, it was pure hell on earth. It was no way to live. So, of course, all these black families are going to get the hell out of there if they can. And not many could. If you think about it, down in those days, it was, you know, sharecropping, migrant farm worker type scenarios. Yes, slavery ended in, 1865? But not really. Not really. That sort of goes on today with all these idiot governors who are, when they're all Republican, by the way, come voting time, know that. They're all voting to get rid of this extended unemployment insurance that is keeping the economy afloat because they want workers to go out and work at fucking Burger King, which there's no shame in that, but a job is not a job. All jobs are not created equal. I was making $25 an hour, but since I can get hired at Wendy's, I should take it? No. So, wage slavery, that's something that exists today as well. So, that's sort of what was going on in the Till household. They wanted to escape. Emmett Till, he was known as Bobo, that was his nickname. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, and though he had obviously experienced racism given the harsh reality of the era, again, he was not prepared for the level of segregation that he encountered in Mississippi. In much more progressive Chicago, black people, white people, they commingle, they work together, they get along to get along. In some cases, they're friendly and they view, you know, white people might view them as human, God forbid. It certainly was, again, a targeted community, the black community was, but when you compare it to the Deep South, it's just insanely different. So, as Emmett Till hits his teens, his uncle from Mississippi, he was a preacher named Mose. He actually went by the nickname Preacher. Now, Mose had come to visit from the Delta, and Emmett could not believe the tales of racism that he was hearing. The lynchings, the working conditions, the way that people could just murder without repercussion, it did not register to Emmett Till, and nor should it have. His Uncle Mose invited him over the summer to come visit in Mississippi to hang out with the cousins, that sort of thing. Part of this was to let Emmett know, hey, things are really tough for our people. Even though it's not exactly cushy in Chicago, you need to be faced with the realities, because I think in a lot of ways it's kind of like how some black families these days have the talk in regards to police officers and so forth. I think this was kind of, tragically and sadly, a way to say, this is our reality. We can adapt, we can move above it, but this is what you are going to face. So Emmett was all on board for this. He, of course, like any kid, wanted to get away. He had only known Chicago. As exciting of a city as Chicago is, sometimes you just want to branch out a little bit. Yeah, he wanted to go see his cousins, and he did want to know if this racism, if this disgusting way of life, the Jim Crow way of life that existed, he wanted to know, could this possibly be real? So Emmett gladly accepted. Now, his mother, Mamie, she knew how the South operated. She's from the South. She gets it. And she has severe misgivings about this trip. It's said that Bobo, or Emmett, was this jovial, charismatic, outgoing, funny kid. He was a prankster, just somebody that everybody liked. He was a bit of a salesman, and he begged his mother for this opportunity. So she had no choice but to cave to his charm, and she allowed him to go down to Mississippi and visit his uncle for the summer. But Mamie, she did warn him to take great caution. And why? For the mere reason that his skin color was different than other people. Now, as she and their neighborhood in Chicago knew, Emmett Till was all about having a great time and had a penchant for fun mischief. Emmett essentially enjoyed playing pranks, much like I do. The thing about that, Southerners in the Jim Crow era had no common sense, let alone a sense of humor. And as we'll find out, not even a sense of goddamn humanity. So, Emmett's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, her warnings about the South, they were not mere matriarchal concerns. In fact, a week before Emmett Till arrived in Mississippi, a black activist named Lamar Smith was shot and killed in front of the county courthouse in Brookhaven, Mississippi, as the police watched for the oh-so-heinous act of political organizing. That's right, he was trying to let black people vote, which was the law, and he was killed while the cops watched in front of the fucking courthouse. Three white suspects were arrested, but, creeps, can you guess what happened? Yep, they were soon released. This was the reality of Mississippi, the poorest state in the country at the time. I am going to go ahead and put these men, all of them collectively, all these hood-wearing idiots, on my list of people to punch in the afterlife. Would you hand the list over, please? Thank you, sir. Though hopefully I will be in heaven and I won't see them, because they're obviously hell people. So Emmett Till, he basically arrives, takes a train ride. He is now in Mississippi. He shows up and it's country bumpkin all around. Emmett Till shows up. He is dressed in his Chicago clothes. He's got the bowler cap. He is Dapper Dan. Everybody else around him is fucking Jethro. He kind of impresses his family. He's got a bunch of cousins. I think he has 8 cousins, something of that nature. They're all impressed. And being a very young kid, he's a child, he's a bit braggadocious. And as he's looking around Mississippi, he's looking around the town, this podunk, nothing, white trash haven. Of course, he's going to brag a little bit about Chicago and how much better things are there. But, and I never thought I'd quote Kid Fucking Rock, but it ain't bragging, motherfucker, if you back it up. Now, let's just get to the event in question, because I want to get it out of the way. It's so gross and heinous. I just can't. So it's August 24th of 1955, Emmett Till has now been in Mississippi for a grand total of 3 days. It's a Sunday. Emmett, another cousin, and cousin Curtis Jones, they skipped church where Uncle Mose, right, was preaching, and they joined some local kids, some neighborhood boys, and they went to Bryant's Grocery and Meal Market to buy candy. Bryant's Grocery and Meal Market is sort of a scam, I would say. This is a place run by this white family, and their entire clientele are black people that are migrant farm workers, sharecroppers, basically indentured servants, basically still legalized slavery. And they treat their clients as such. This is not modern times. This is basically the 1800s all over again. And somehow the South has allowed this to happen. So the boys are standing outside of this country store in Money, Mississippi, which is an ironic name because there's no money to be had in this whole place. He's 3 days in on his visit. Emmett's doing his thing. He's bragging a little bit. He's talking about home. So he pulls out a photograph, and this is a picture of his integrated high school. His integrated school class back home. I don't think he was in high school. He would have been in junior high. The boys could not believe it. This was something unheard of. They did not believe him when he said he had white classmates, etc., etc. And they definitely didn't believe it when he said he had a white girlfriend. Well, he pulls out this picture and they are shell-shocked because their entire life has been lived under a cloak of darkness and fear of white people. Emmett bragged, you know, this is my girlfriend back home, she's white, blah, blah, blah. Side note, well, who was this girl? Did she even exist? We actually found out in recent years, yes, she did. Now, like, almost 70 plus years later, she is discovered to be one Joan Brody. Joan Brody gave her first interview about Emmett Till to a Clarion Ledger reporter and others at her condo on the north side of Chicago. This was just a few years back. So, yes, they were together. She described him as being a very sweet boy, someone with manners, but still charming, a prankster, but good-natured, that sort of thing. So let's go back 70 years, though, to the street corner right in front of the marketplace. Emmett's African-American companions, again, they still kind of disbelieve him because they've never seen such a thing. They've never heard of such a thing. So they dare Emmett to go into the, Bryant's Meat Market, and asked the white woman behind the store counter for a date. They did this because they were sort of trying to call Emmett's bluff. Because again, they're not realizing Emmett's from Chicago. This is nothing for him to do. It is not a big deal. He talks to white people all the time. To them, they kind of like, I want to shut this kid up. There's no way he would do that. Well, he would, because he's from Chicago, and he has some hope that there's fucking humanity out there, and he can talk to a white woman. It's ridiculous. Back then, even the suggestion of sexual contact between black men and white women, it would carry severe penalties for black men. Mostly, they would be lynched. I mean, I keep saying it, but this is the reality of the times. This is KKK country, where the judges, the cops, they're all wearing that stupid white sheet, fucking low IQ toga party or whatever you want to call it. They just, again, would not believe that Emmett could do something like this. Being from the North, Emmett Till could not believe their fear. He just could not believe the things they were saying could possibly be real. Because, honestly, who the fuck could? Okay, so Emmett Till goes into the store there. He kind of moseys about, blah, blah, blah. Kind of building up the energy, the confidence to do this thing inside of Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market. And his friends and his cousins, they sort of gathered outside the door a little bit to eavesdrop. Scared shitless because they can't believe, wow, we just got this kid into a lot of fucking trouble. Because if he does this, there's going to be hell to pay. Now, inside the store, it's only Emmett Till and this disgusting woman named Carolyn Bryant. Carolyn Bryant's children and her sister-in-law's children and her sister-in-law were in the back room. So what actually went on is only corroborated through things that people heard from the outside and kind of pieced together by the authorities. So, he's in the store. He buys some candy. On his way out, the boys outside hear him say, "Bye, baby," to the woman, Carolyn Bryant. Again, no witnesses, but Emmett and Carolyn Bryant. Well, clutch my pearls. That was outrageous for Mississippi. So Carolyn Bryant, the woman behind the counter, she claimed that later Emmett Till grabbed her, made lewd advances, and he catcalled her as he sauntered about the store. I'm going to tell you, creeps, I'm going to put it up on my Twitter and the group. When you see the image of Carolyn Bryant, who I like to call Pig Lady, you'll just know she was lying. This ratchet pig woman was a hell person with bad eyebrows who looks like she got walloped in the face with a bag of nickels. It's said that in her history, this high school dropout won 2 fucking beauty contests. Well, we have eyes, and I don't know, was the beauty contest against a row of abandoned outhouses? No fucking way. She was ugly as sin. Oh, and her husband, the guy's like my age and he's bald. He looks like he could collect Social Security. Just disgusting. We'll get to him later. So yeah, we got this ratchet pig woman with her story. Nonetheless, that was her story. It is agreed that Emmett Till did the catcall in order to win the bet, but that was the extent of it. Another one of Till's cousins, Simeon Wright, who was outside of the store, he stated that Emmett did indeed whistle at Carolyn Bryant, the pig woman, saying, quote, "I think Emmett wanted to get a laugh out of us or something." Furthering, "He was always joking around, and it was hard to tell when he was serious." Wright stated that after the harmless whistle, he became immediately alarmed and shaken, as he should have, given the era, saying, quote, "Well, it scared us half to death. And, you know, we were almost in shock. We couldn't get out of there fast enough because we had never heard of anything like that before. A black boy whistling at a white woman? In Mississippi? No." After Wright and Emmett Till exit the store front steps, that pig lady, Carolyn Bryant, with her bad eyebrows, she goes outside and she goes to her car. Underneath the car is a pistol. She pulls it out. It's a scare tactic. The teenagers see her do this and leave immediately. I think she was just shaken that the nerve somebody of color would whistle at her. She should be flattered anybody would whistle at her, honestly, but this was people's attitudes at the time. I sort of wish she would have taken that pistol and shot herself in the face. It would have been an improvement and might have given her a real chance in an actual beauty competition. Now, this chubby, bald, lard-ass Roy Bryant, he is Pig Lady's husband, and he is the proprietor of the store. He returns home from a business trip a few days later and hears, not from his wife, but from people that hang out at the shop, he hears rumors about what went on secondhand. He hears how Emmett had allegedly spoken to his wife. And you know how rumors go. Maybe he put his hand on her waist. All this bullshit, right? So he's enraged. So he goes to the home of Mose Wright, the preacher, who is Emmett Till's uncle, along with his half-brother, J.W. Malam, who is this complete douchebag type of guy you can tell just wants to get into fights and wants to be a tough guy because life dealt him a bad hand, blah, blah, blah. They go to Mose Wright's home in the early morning hours of August 28th between 2 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. They have in the bed of their truck, they have a couple of black boys, and they are scared to death. These are not snitches. These are not people that are Benedict Arnolds. They're not traitors. They're not anything. They are frightened for their lives because these men have them under a fucking gun saying, you're going to help us do this. Again, the reality of the Jim Crow era South. So they get to the house. J.W. Malam is armed with a pistol and a flashlight. He asked Preacher Wright if he had three boys in the house from Chicago. So again, you can see there's only one person from Chicago, but stupid idiot South rumors are flying. Emmett Till was sharing a bed with a cousin, and there were about eight people in this small two-bedroom cabin. J.W. Malam then asked Wright, by the way, why is Malam doing all the talking? Because it's not even his wife. Roy Bryant's a coward. Malam, anyway, where was I? I get so frustrated with this case. Malam asked Wright to take them to, and I hate this, but this is the quote, I'm not going to say the word, to take them to, quote, the N-word, who did the talking. Emmett Till's great aunt, she's born and bred in the South. She knows what time it is. She offers the men money to leave, money that she cannot afford to lose. But this asshole, J.W. Malam, he refuses, and he rushes Emmett Till to put on his clothes. Mose Wright informed the men that Till was from up north and, quote, didn't know any better. That excuse didn't fly, and it's not an excuse that should have had to have been said. It doesn't matter where he's from, obviously. J.W. Malam reportedly then asked, how old are you, preacher? To which the preacher responded, I'm 64. Malam threatened that if Wright told anybody about what was happening, he would not live to see the age of 65. So, Emmett Till is now dressed. The men march him out to the truck. They drive around in the night, beating Emmett Till. Then they stop in a tool house behind J.W. Malam's residence, and they continue beating the shit out of him, in and out of consciousness. Then they drive him down to the Tallahatchie River. Once there, they pistol whip him and reportedly knocked him unconscious. They wake him up again. They force him to carry a 75-pound cotton gin fan. Keep in mind, this kid, that's half his body weight, if not more. He's just out of puberty. He's a child. They force him to carry the 75-pound cotton gin fan to the bank of the Tallahatchie River and ordered him to take off his clothes. These two cowards then beat him to death. They gouged out his eye. They shot him in the head. They took that cotton gin and just crushed it on his face, which is why that iconic photo looks the way that it does. Then they throw his body, which is tied to the cotton gin fan with barbed wire, into the river. Are you feeling disgusted yet? Okay, creeps, so moving on with the story. It's now 3 days later after the brutal murder of a child at the hands of these two wretched abomination. I guess they call themselves men, but they're really not. Emmett Till's corpse is recovered, but he's so disfigured that his uncle Mose Wright can only identify it by this initiated ring that Emmett was wearing. Authorities wanted to bury the body and the story quite quickly, But wisely, in one of the best bad bitch moves of all time, Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, smartly requested that, no, I want this body sent back to Chicago. This would go on and prove to be something that would change history and hold a presence in the annals of the civil rights movement. This horrific image that no mother should ever have to see would just change the lives of millions going forward. But at the time, oh, can you just imagine? After seeing the grossly mutilated remains, and that is an understatement, but I don't want to exploit it. It's disgusting, and you'll see that picture if you wish to. She decided to have an open casket funeral so that the world could see what these racist murderers had done to her only son. At this funeral, 100,000 plus Southside Chicago residents attended. Jet Magazine, that's an African American weekly magazine, which I believe is still in publication. At the time, they were huge. They were kind of like, well, you hear about things like Black Twitter these days. That was sort of black media for the time. And they published a photo of Emmett Till's corpse. And the mainstream media, due to the grotesque nature and shock value, they picked up on the story shortly after. The newspaper coverage and the murder trial galvanized a generation of young African Americans to join the civil rights movement because they were fearing that such an atrocity, if it can happen to a boy, a kid, it could definitely happen to them or their family or their friends. Many interviewees in the Civil Rights History Project later on, they would remember how this case deeply affected their lives, and I'll go into that a little bit later. So, less than 2 weeks after Emmett Till's massacred body was buried in Chicago, so screw you, Mississippi, the Hell People / White Trash J.W. Malam and Roy Bryant go on trial in a segregated, of course, courthouse in Sumner, Mississippi. Well, no hotels are open for black visitors. Mamie Till Bradley arrives all the way from Chicago to testify, and this trial obviously attracts many prominent members of the African American community, including Congressman Charles Diggs from Michigan. So, you've got Emmett's mother, you've got this congressman, and several black reporters. They stayed at a gentleman named T.R.M. Howard's home in Mound Bayou, Mississippi, located on a large lot and surrounded by armed guards. It resembled a compound. And sadly, creeps, it had to due to very real threats. I mean, it was needed. Now, press from major national newspapers attended, again, including some black publications. The black reporters were required to sit in the segregated black section during the trial, away from the white press, way far away from the jury. This part's pretty sickening. The sheriff, his name is Sheriff Strider, and as the black spectators are coming back from lunch one day, he welcomes them sarcastically and loudly with a very, very cheerful, "Hello," N-words. Visitors from the North, black or white, they were in shock how this court could be run with such, well, informality. They just couldn't believe the segregation, how backwoods everything really was. Jury members were allowed to drink beer while on duty during this case, and many white male spectators, most actually, wore handguns in the courtroom. Look, the image of a backwoods hick was not a stereotype at this time. These people were that. There were a few witnesses besides Mose Wright, the uncle, who courageously, positively identified the defendants as Emmett's killers. Nobody's going to say anything because if they implicate these two white men, they know they're going to get off and then they're going to get lynched and their family's going to be murdered and it's going to be... There's no justice on their side. There's nothing. They have nothing but each other. But Emmett's uncle decided to be a hero, which I believe he is a hero. So he identifies them during the murder trial. That pig lady, Carolyn Bryant, now her story changes a little bit. Now she's testifying that Emmett Till grabbed her hand while she was stocking candy and said, "How about a date, baby?" It's like, don't flatter or kid yourself, Uggo. She said that after she freed herself from his grasp, this literal child followed her to the cash register, grabbed her waist, and said, "What's the matter, baby? Can't you take it?" I call bullshit. Don't you call bullshit, Woodrow? Because what child of the 50s spoke like that? Few people spoke like that, and if they did, they were adults. This is all made up bullshit. Carolyn Bryant said she freed herself, and Emmett Till said, "You needn't be afraid of me, baby." And then he used one, quote, unprintable word, and then said, "I've been with white women before." Nope, not buying this. This is so coached and rehearsed and staged. It's disgusting. Well, speaking of disgusting, you want to know? Let's go to September 23rd of that year. The all-white jury, and this is because women and black people were banned from serving on the jury. Talk about a jury of your peers, right? They deliberated for way less than an hour before issuing the verdict of not guilty, explaining that they believed the state had failed to prove the identity of the body. Then, this fucking Hilljack juror later said, quote, "If we hadn't stopped to drink pop, it wouldn't have taken that long." You're probably dead already, but dude, go fuck yourself, you shit potato inbred. When you're done fucking your sister, that is. Now, many people around the country were outraged by this decision. Oh, and also by the state's decision not to indict J.W. Malam and Roy Bryant on a separate charge that they admitted to, and that was kidnapping. In November of 55, a grand jury declined to indict them for this kidnapping, despite their own admissions. Now, creeps, the following is gross, but it's the actual transcript from an interview in Look magazine from J.W. Malam himself. I'm going to read this. It's hard to read. It's gross. And I should say, he benefited from his crimes. He benefited from murder. He got paid $4,000 for this interview. And Look magazine was a big magazine at the time. This circulated everywhere. This is him admitting this in a magazine. Okay, brace yourselves because I can't... I'm telling you, this is just disgusting speech. From Malam himself, quote, "Well, what else could we do? He was hopeless. I'm no bully. I never heard a N-word in my life. I like N-words in their place. I know how to work 'em. But I just decided it was time a few people got put on notice. As long as I live and can do anything about it, N-words are gonna stay in their place. That word again, ain't gonna vote where I live. If they did, they'd control the government. They ain't gonna go to school with my kids. And when that word again, gets close to mentioning sex with a white woman, he's tired of living. I'm likely to kill him. Me and my folks fought for this country, and we got some rights. I stood there in that shed and listened to that word, throw that poison at me, and I just made up my mind. Chicago boy, I said, I'm tired of them sending your kind down here to stir up trouble. God damn you, I'm going to make an example of you. Just so everybody can know how me and my folks stand. Well, slow clap, aren't you just the fucking big man on campus? Aren't you just the white supremacist hero? Two grown men took on a little boy. I think we need some levity, because I'm about to get into a time machine and do some damage to this prick. So, with that, let's have some levity, shall we? Well, creeps, it's time once again for the Woodrow Comedy Minute that lasts longer than a minute. We need some lighthearted jokes today for levity, especially during such a heinous episode. So Woodsy has promised to keep it goofy and palate cleansing. What? Woodrow, no one is going to call you a hack for taking a week off from trying to be edgy and deep. Sorry, creeps. Why are you always so self-conscious? What do you mean I should be more self-conscious? Okay. I most certainly do not dress like Adam Sandler's aborted Siamese twin. Ugh. You are the worst. Sorry, creeps. This reminds me of the time we had this ninja throwing star game of tag in the aisle at the Toys R Us in Tulsa back in 1991. Stupid idea. All the crying kids and shit. I've still got, what do they call that, shrapnel in my ocular cavity? Let's get on with it. Joke one, creeps. Why can't your nose be 12 inches long? Because then it would be a foot. Okay. Joke 2. Easy breezy, lighthearted style. What is the difference between a poorly dressed man on a tricycle and a well-dressed man on a bicycle? Attire. Oh, I get it. Because attire is clothing and attire is the difference between a tricycle and a bicycle. Okay, moving on. Final joke. How do you make a Swiss roll? You push him down a hill. Ah, you've done it again, fam. Well, creeps, what can I say? That's our Woodrow. And now, back to the show. Okay, so the Emmett Till murder trial, it brought the brutality of Jim Crow segregation in the South to the much more cultured and progressive North, although again, not perfect. The North was much better, and this served to be an early impetus of the civil rights movement. Now, this is going to grind your gears a little bit, because it ground up mine for damn sure. In 2017, this cat named Tim Tyson, he's the author of a book called The Blood of Emmett Till. He had an interview with Carolyn Bryant, the pig lady. And guess what? Carolyn Bryant recanted her testimony and admitted during this interview, in her gross pig lady voice, that Emmett Till had, in fact, never touched, never threatened, nor had ever harassed her. A quote from this bitch: "Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him." She's around 82 or something at this time, some 60 years later. She confesses this to this Duke University professor. She says she lied about the entire event. She was sort of looking for attention. I guess bored, that's disgusting to say, but bored in the Deep South. Her husband's looking to stir up some stuff because, you know, he's Mr. Important, he's a big tough guy. So she made everything up. Well, she's apologizing, but I say, too late, hell person. You clutched your pearls when it mattered and brutally murdered a kid. You are as guilty as your disgusting husband and the impotent, limp dick, wet noodle brother-in-law. Protected against double jeopardy, that's when that magazine interview came out in Look magazine. So they admitted to killing Emmett Till. In over 65 years, not a single person has been held accountable for Emmett Till, a very young teenager. No one's been held accountable for his death. Not one fucking day has been spent in jail. Not one iota of a cent has been paid in compensation. But although human justice did not prevail, there is a higher ground, I believe, creeps. There is something more cosmic. And that, my babies, is karma. And karma can be a bitch. And it sure as hell was for the Bryant and Malam families. After this event, well, Bryant's store, it went out of business because, guess what? The black community in that town said, fuck you. We don't care if we starve, you're gonna starve. They stopped going to the store, and the store had no clientele because who wants to be a client of somebody who murders your own kind? So they go out of business. Then, well, let's go to J.W. Malam second. So he ends up sort of doing menial jobs. He can't get a job anywhere, right? So he does these menial jobs in plantations. He gets in trouble. He gets arrested. He goes to jail because he's writing bad checks. There was a National News Wire photographer who snapped a photograph of J.W. Malam waiting in line in a bread line amongst, God forbid, black people. And this humiliated him to no end. And then, later, his home got foreclosed upon because he could not find work. And in the sweetest of irony, guess what happened to that house after it was pulled out from under him? That home was converted into an African-American church. Ah, sometimes you gotta give God up there the old slow golf clap. As for Pig Lady and her bald husband, the Bryants, as I mentioned, their store went out of business. Then they divorced. Then Roy Bryant, he gets in trouble with the law because he engages in food stamp fraud. Then this idiot decides, I want to be a police officer. And he applies to be a police officer in the very same town where the police watched his back and let him get away with murder. But at this point in time, I'm sure their attitudes hadn't changed, but now the world's watching. So he gets turned away from being a police officer because the sinners in that town don't want to be associated with its biggest sinner. Nobody wanted anything to do with this dirtbag. And lastly, before he died of cancer, which I hope was long and painful, Roy Bryant and J.W. Malam, who like to give interviews about killing young kids and magazines in their trashy little accent. Not saying all Southerners have a trashy accent. I commingle in the South. There's a difference between white trash and, you know, Southern Belles. So, but these people were white trash. So J.W. Malam and Roy Bryant, towards the end of their pursuits of trying to find a reason to live, they run for alderman. That's right. That is a localized government position to be an alderman. There's a big list of people running for alderman. They both put themselves on said list, and as the results are tallied, they tied. for the absolute lowest fucking votes in town. So, they can go to hell, and it looks like karma kind of made their life hell foreverwards after the fact. Like many, Emmett Till, he didn't get to live a long life, but his life meant a lot more than most people's lives ever will. Emmett Till's murder was seen as a major, major catalyst for the next phase of the civil rights movement. In December of 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott, the very famous one, began in Alabama, and it lasted for more than a year, resulting eventually in the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that segregated buses were unconstitutional. Now, I'm not entirely certain the Supreme Court was woke, but they had to do what they had to do because that bus line, it was going under. They were going out of business without the black business. It goes to show you the power we have as consumers. According to historians, events surrounding Emmett Till's life and death continue to resonate. Historians have suggested that almost every story about Mississippi eventually finds its way back to Emmett Till or the Delta region in which he died. It's like some spiritual homing way. Take Rosa Parks on her refusal to move to the back of the bus, the whole thing that launched the aforementioned Montgomery bus boycott. Rosa Parks said when she was told to go to the back of the bus, quote, "I thought of Emmett Till, and I just couldn't go back." Dr. Martin Luther King would use the momentum of outrage to galvanize the nation against social and racial injustice. He would invoke Till's murder when talking about the, quote, "evil of racial injustice" in several speeches, as well as the famous line, "the crying voice of a little Emmett C. Till, screaming from the rushing waters in Mississippi," in a 1963 Mother's Day sermon. 8 years later, on the anniversary of Emmett Till's murder, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic "I Have a Dream" speech at the March on Washington. This also, young black people at the time, they became known as the Emmett Till generation. Just a few examples. Members and people who would identify as part of this generation would be the late John Lewis, who we might know from the phrase "good trouble." You have also Ann Moody and Muhammad Ali. They all had their lives changed by it. In fact, Muhammad Ali was Cassius Clay, as most people know, until he discovered what was going on. He had all of his handlers and managers and people taking money from him that were all his fans. Everybody was white, but they viewed him as a puppet, as a form of entertainment, not as a man. This inspired him to accept his blackness, and he changed his name to Muhammad Ali. This affected his life greatly. And it's not just famous people, it's everybody. So, politicians, sure, but this was a time of change in America, and Emmett Till's case spurred it on. I saw something the other day. In the New York Times, there are 600 plus articles about Emmett Till. One third of those articles have been written in the past 8 years. So for every Michael Brown, for every George Floyd, for every Tamir Rice, for every anybody, I mean, there's so many to name because every time you turn on your television set, something's going down. But for every victim of racial brutality, violence, for every murder victim, it all comes back to Emmett Till. And when these things happen, people research Emmett Till, and they know that history does repeat itself. It's just that back then, there was no social media. There wasn't even really television. It was all newspapers controlled by white supremacists. You didn't hear about this stuff.
it took the courage of Emmett Till's mother to hold this funeral with an open casket where her son's face was too deformed to even look at. It took the courage of his uncle to point out these guilty people. It took the courage of the community to essentially banish the murderers from that community. All of this came from Emmett Till. I think a good comparison, if you look at Anne Frank, she's sort of a martyr because it's her story that told the real truth, the real tale of the Holocaust from a babe's mouth, right? From the mouth of babes. And in America, when it comes to the black experience regarding civil rights and that sort of thing, Emmett Till, he was the Anne Frank for the Jim Crow racist South. I guess that's where I'm going to leave it there. It's, again, it's so gross, but, you know, so much good came from it. And let's face it, we all know the name Emmett Till. But J.W. Malam, what's the other guy? The Bryants, Roy Bryant, and the pig lady, Carolyn Bryant. I have to look their names up just to remember who the fuck they are. They're nobodies. And that, my creeps, is victory. Well, creeps, I said it was going to be a rough journey, and I think that it definitely was. But, again, it was and is an important journey. The injustice that we seemingly see daily on the news has been happening for many years. We just haven't always had the social media or even television to cover it. In fact, back in the day, it was all newspapers and newspapers. My God, they were ran by the KKK. It's hard to think about this, but this happened not that long ago. I think my father might have been born the same year, if not close. It's a whole thing. Also, I don't want this to seem like a pile-on for the South, just as we don't pile on modern-day Germans for what the Nazis did. But it's quite disheartening how an entire population of people could embrace such vitriol and hatred as the norm in between trips to PTA meetings and church. I will say that America is mostly great, but we should never blindly believe that we are some utopia. Now, in the South, there were a lot of white people that thought this was atrocious. They stood up against it. Or some wanted to stand up against it. Give them a credit. I'll give them their credit. There just wasn't enough of them. It's funny. I didn't even plan this, but I'm looking on my shelf right now. I have a dog-eared copy of a paperback of To Kill a Mockingbird. That book, Harper Lee, comes to mind, for example, of a Southerner who hated the Jim Crow era in her town. Now, while fiction, the book was about Scout and Jem. Scout's childhood has this Southern charm, this whimsical way about it, but we meet the greatest character in literary history, in my opinion, their father Atticus Finch, who is defending Tom Robinson, a not guilty, but accused of rape black man who does end up being killed by the white mob regardless of his innocence. Harper Lee was sort of telling the story of the South to the world through that book, and that's just an example. I don't know which came first, the book or the Emmett Till case, but boy, they sure are similar. And if they're similar by accident, it just goes to show you this was a common theme back in the day. Again, it's a very, very important moment in history. I must again thank everyone who's been helping the show. You are my lifeline. You are what keeps me going. Please help out if you can. I know times are tough. You can do so by going to patreon.com/creepycrawl. You can give me a nice little boost so I can get some microphones going here on Venmo at jonathan-allen-154. Do follow me on the Bluebird, the Twitter. That handle is at writerjohnallen, no H. I like to post photos and other things, accoutrements that tie these stories together. And lastly, I just started the Facebook group, so go to facebook.com/groups/thecreepycrawlpodcast. We can rap, we can chat, we can pick topics, we can dissect topics. The imaginary fake pretend outro music today, I'm going to go with one of my top five all-time favorites. It's the late, great Sam Cooke. And the civil rights anthem, A Change Is Gonna Come. Because, creeps, it's coming slowly. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it's coming at all. But a change, one day, is gonna come. Until next time, keep an optimistic eye on the future, a cautious eye on the past, and creepy crawl on.